This is the Late Round Podcast with your host, JJ Zacharisa.
What's up, everyone? It's JJ Zacharyson, the editor-in-chief over at NumberFire.com, and this is episode 126 of the Late Round Podcast, one of the many shows that are part of the NumberFire Podcast Network. Thanks for tuning in. So as I talked about on Tuesday, I finished my initial projections for this upcoming fantasy football season over the weekend. And as a result, I decided to send a string of tweets on Twitter with some thoughts on what I found while they were being created. One of the things that I noted was that Mike Evans was projected to be the wide receiver 13, which is a little bit lower than where his ADP is at. And with limited characters, I noted that part of the reason is because there's a lot of competition for targets in that Tampa Bay offense. It was the too many mouths to feed argument. Just so you guys can understand the concept a little bit, just think of an NFL passing offense as a giant pie. And then each receiver gets a chunk of that pie, which comes in the form of a target share or the percentage of targets a player sees within his offense. For wide receivers, a target share above 20% is usually pretty good. And then anything that hits 30% is uber elite and not sustainable. The top receivers in the game, like Antonio Brown and Julio Jones, they usually see target shares between 27 and 29%, with random outlier years thrown in there when they reach 30%. Julio Jones in 2015, for instance, saw almost 33% of Atlanta's targets. So that number can regress to a mean for a particular player. DeAndre Hopkins is a really good example. Last year, he saw a ridiculous 33.1% of Houston's targets. That was a career high, and it was the second highest share that we've seen over the last 7 years. So you just can't project DeAndre Hopkins to see that again this year. It's not reasonable. He'll more than likely fall backwards in that department to somewhere closer to 28 or 29%. It's easy to see how a new addition to a team can then alter the way a player's volume output looks. DJ Moore going to the Panthers, for example, means that Devin Funchess may have a harder time hitting his 22% target share mark that he saw last season. Nothing really changed in the Panthers' receiving game aside from it adding weapons like DJ Moore and Torrey Smith, and since Funchess isn't a locked-in elite player at his position, it's not unreasonable to think that his target share is going to drop. This is the obvious reason the too many mouths to feed argument is valid. Now let's shift our focus back to Mike Evans. Last year, Mike Evans saw a 22.5% target share in Tampa's offense in 15 games. In 2016, that number was about 30% in 16 games. Evans was more banged up in 2017, and that didn't help his cause. I totally get it. But there's no way that you can frame his 2017 season as being close to the same volume-wise as his 2016 campaign. So then you have to ask the question, why? Well, the obvious big addition to Tampa Bay's offense was DeSean Jackson. Even though Jackson didn't make as big of an impact as some would have hoped for, he did see a higher target share than any non-Evans wide receiver over the last two seasons. And Jackson only played 14 games, too. There were a lot of things that happened with the Bucs last year, including Jameis Winston not even playing the full season. But this does provide evidence that Evans is not immune to the many mouths to feed argument. And if you believe the DeSean Jackson impact is just minimal, which it very may well be, the Bucs' offense is different this year. It's not that their pass-catching personnel looks that different, but you've got Cameron Brate signing a new deal this offseason, and O.J. Howard and Chris Godwin are now another year in the league. They should, hypothetically, be better. And if they're better, they may get a larger share of targets in the offense. If they take a larger piece of the pie, some of that pie may be taken away from Mike Evans. And to be clear, guys, I'm not saying that Mike Evans is all of a sudden going to see 18% of Tampa Bay's targets because O.J. Howard and Chris Godwin are sophomores in the league. I'm just saying that I don't think Evans is in this Antonio Brown or Julio Jones-like tier where he deserves to be force-fed the ball. There's some sort of hit, like a 1% or 2% hit, let's say, to his overall target share numbers based on the number of weapons Jameis Winston has at his disposal. That's just one of the many, many things on my mind this week. There's so much happening because we've just finished the NFL draft and people are getting amped about this upcoming fantasy football season. So we've got a lot of questions for this week's mailbag episode as a result. Let's dig in. This first question says, JJ, really enjoyed the draft follow-up podcast that focused on front office ideologies. I had a running back question on your model's rookie projections. I noticed that your 2018 rookie running back projections seemed to far exceed the 27 actuals from last year's rookies. There were only two 1,000-yard rushers, and the third leading rusher was in the 700s. Those same top three rushed for 9, 8, and 8 touchdowns respectively, with the next highest at 5. Is this an inclination that the 2018 class consists of more immediate producers, or just better situation placement? Thanks, Rob. I posted my rookie projections on NumberFire this week for premium members, and so you guys are aware, I'm currently projecting 3 running backs to hit the 1,000-yard mark this season. Those backs are Saquon Barkley, Rashad Penny, and Darius Geis. I'm just noting that so that I'm clear with how many guys I think could hit 1,000 yards. But I think the answer to this question has 3 parts. The first is that injuries happen, and my projections don't account for a dude potentially missing 6 games with a foot sprain. Injuries will happen most with running backs, but it's impossible to know which running back is going to be hurt. The second is that teams spent more on running backs this year than last year in the NFL draft. I'll talk more about draft equity in a bit, but that matters because they'll see more opportunity, and opportunity drives fantasy value. And the third thing is that this draft has more early down backs than last year's draft. Like Darius Geis is looking to be more of a 2-down guy because of Chris Thompson's presence. And his fantasy value won't look that great as a result, but he'll still be running the football a lot in that offense. Nick Chubb is kind of the same way, but I don't have Chubb projected for 1,000 yards yet because Carlos Hyde is in that offense. But that's why the projections are the way that they are. They're not factoring in injuries, this class had more draft equity spent on it, and the class itself has more early down runners as well. This next question says, "Hi JJ, question for the late round pod. I've heard you and other people I trust, like Eric Eager, talk about how throwing to running backs is less efficient than throwing to wide receivers and tight ends. If this is true, why are we seeing so many more pass-catching running backs and more targets going to running backs? Simple NFL inefficiency? Or does it relate to a general increase in passing volume? The narrative you often hear is that a dynamic pass-catching back can create mismatches against slower linebackers. Is there any truth to this narrative? Love the pod, Chris." When I talk about throwing to running backs, I'm looking at things from a bird's eye view and saying, hey, according to our expected points model and according to yards per target, throwing to tight ends and wide receivers has been a more effective thing to do than throwing to a running back over the last 5 years. A lot of it has to do with the fact that running backs are catching passes that have low average depth of targets, but that's also the point. You'd be better off targeting a player down the field more. But there are instances where a running back is creating more value than the average tight end or wide receiver, and there are also instances where a running back can still be a better option only because of the rest of the team sucks. And sometimes it is situational. But what the data is telling us is that the way coaches are currently using running backs in the passing game on the whole is not necessarily optimal. Again, there are instances where it is optimal on a play-by-play basis, but the bad is outweighing the good here. I also think that there's a lot of room for growth in this area too. That's a key takeaway for me with really any of this analysis. It's not that it can't work, it's just that given history, it hasn't worked. It's not that Saquon Barkley can't be a revolutionary pass catcher at the position. It's just that it's not a likely scenario given what's happened in history. But back to your question of how we're seeing more targets to running backs. This is true, we are. Running backs saw over 3,700 targets last year, which is about 300 more than what they'd seen the year prior. The overall target share for backs last year was 21.2%, when that number was 18.5% the year before. And over the last 6 or 7 seasons, we'd seen between 19 and 20% of the targets going to running backs. So they are being used more. I just want to see coaches get more creative and make them more efficient. The next one is another one about the running back position. It says, "Hey JJ, as always, great work with the content you provide. I now listen to probably too many podcasts, which makes it difficult to keep up, but with yours, I never fall behind because of your efficient, to-the-point episodes." Hey, thanks. "You use contracts to help drive home your point on running back value, but I would contend their salaries aren't low due to their impact, but rather due to primarily to a couple of other factors. Teams will continue to use a first and second round pick on talented running backs because that high-end ability and reliability is not as replaceable as numbers may show. And as you know, running back is one of the easier positions to get instant production from out of college. It's just that once that rookie contract is up, it's hard for a team to justify doling out big money when their shelf life is short and they can get that instant production out of the next high-end rookie they draft. This is why I believe there is a disparity between draft capital value and salary figures at the position. Thoughts? Thanks, Justin." I think there's validity to the argument for sure. Teams aren't giving out second contracts to running backs because of their short shelf life, so if you disagree with the analysis that I've done and others have done on the importance of the running back position, then you can probably understand spending a higher draft pick on one. To be honest, this is part of the reason why I can understand a team with fewer holes making a first-round running back pick as opposed to one who has holes now and will in the short-term future. My issue, though, is that there's still an opportunity cost involved in doing this. You shouldn't be drafting players based solely on how they'll perform during their first 4 or 5 seasons of their career. You still want long-lasting players. If you know a running back has a short shelf life, then it makes less sense to spend a lot of draft capital on him when you have the potential to get a franchise passer for over a decade. And to be fair, teams still aren't spending incredible draft capital on running backs when compared to the typical impact positions these days like quarterback, edge rush, and cornerback. Teams definitely view things this way with running back contracts, though. There's no doubt about it. I just think that there are more optimal ways of spending the draft capital itself. This next question is from Joe. It says, strategy question, auction draft. What do you think about targeting players that all have the same bye week? So basically, you take a loss that one week, but the rest of the season your team is full strength, not depleted by one or two players each week, and you wouldn't have to worry about filling positions for byes either. Obviously, this would depend on the schedule each year and who lines up with who, and you might not even be able to make a good team depending on where their byes line up. I haven't checked for this year yet. But in theory, if you could make it work, would this be a pretty significant advantage weekly? I feel like it would be. I might try it out this year. Thanks, Joe. My general go-to answer with questions like this one is that if you're reaching for something that probably has just a slight advantage, if any at all, and it forces you to then be suboptimal with your decision-making, it's not a worthwhile thing to do. Meaning, this is something that really probably wouldn't impact your overall season very much at all. Not only does it assume that you'll hit on your players and the guys that you draft for a particular bye week are the ones that you'll always be starting throughout the season, but it assumes that you won't be getting value off the waiver wire or you won't obtain other starters throughout the season. So much of your roster will look different when that bye week actually hits. But it also could force you to be suboptimal choosing a player because of the bye week instead of choosing the player because he's better and projects to have a better season. That's why I think, generally speaking, this is kind of overthinking it. This next question says, hey JJ, how much do you factor in draft capital when judging a player? I know you include it in your projections formula, but how much of an impact does it have? For example, with a player like Mike Williams, does his draft capital salvage his dynasty value despite a subpar situation and bad 2017 season? Thanks, Jack. Draft capital is important for two main reasons, volume and prospecting. The volume side means that a team will more likely use that player above another player who was drafted far later. So if two players are of the same talent level and you have a first rounder and a sixth rounder, that first rounder is going to see the field quicker. But from a prospecting standpoint, we have to keep in mind that while teams make mistakes all the time in the draft, they're still drafting players who they think are good. Like there's still a correlation between talented and productive players being selected early versus guys selected late. Antonio Brown is such an outlier because we usually don't see Hall of Fame type wide receivers get drafted as late as he was drafted. And same thing with Tom Brady. But overall, that's why draft capital matters. But at the same time, we shouldn't overrate it because how a player performs is still more important. I'm going to elaborate more though with this next question. This next one says, hi JJ, obviously draft capital and landing spot matters a lot, but how is that reconciled with pre-draft rankings? Across the Dynasty community, it seems that Equanimeous St. Brown is being rated substantially higher than Jamon Moore, 18 versus 36 ADP on DynastyLeagueFootball.com, even though the Packers clearly rated Moore and even Marquez Valdes-Scantling above St. Brown. I preferred St. Brown pre-draft as well, but it seems to me it is a bit of arrogance to rank him substantially higher given their draft positions. Rob. I actually had another question about the Packers wide receivers too, so I figured that I'd get to this one. To me, I don't think that we should care that much about the difference between one day three pick from another. This is similar to last season with Aaron Jones and Jamal Williams. I like Jones a lot more as a prospect than Jamal Williams, and since the amount of draft capital spent on Aaron Jones versus Jamal Williams was not that significant, I backed Jones above Jamal Williams. I think this is kind of similar where I can't really fault someone for placing St. Brown above the other two wide receivers if they think that he's far and away the better prospect. But I do think the Packers clearly like Jamon Moore the most. And as a result, St. Brown may be a little overrated in the Dynasty community right now. And that's coming from someone who had St. Brown as a fringe top five wideout entering the draft. This next question says, love the podcast and the Twitter follow. Can't tell you how much more confident I am in fantasy since I started reading and listening your stuff. Thanks. I was wondering just how far John Kelly has fallen for you post-draft in terms of dynasty value. I was all set to grab him in my 20-team dynasty auction league, but now that he is in fantasy purgatory behind Todd Gurley, I was wondering if I should just scrap him and focus more on getting an Ito Smith type, or do you still believe in the talent enough that he can somehow have fantasy relevance? Thanks for everything you do, man. Justin. John Kelly has become a dart throw in dynasty leagues where you're just crossing your fingers that a Todd Gurley injury happens. And I don't mean that by you should be rooting for a Todd Gurley injury, you guys. I just mean that Kelly won't be relevant until something happens to Todd Gurley. This is honestly an extreme example of why situation matters. I love John Kelly as a player and think that he's really good, but he fell a round or two later than I thought that he'd go in the draft, and he's behind one of the true bell cows in football. That means that you have to devalue him. But know that if something does happen to Todd Gurley, Kelly is more than capable than what most might assume. This last question says, JJ, appreciate what you do and your willingness to have constructive dialogue about lots of issues related to fantasy football. Congrats on being a future dad. Thanks. My question, what is one overarching lesson that you've learned over the years in creating projections at this point in the offseason? Obviously, there are lots of training camp battles and depth chart issues that need to be sorted out, but in terms of your models, what is a principle that you've held on to throughout the years? Kyle. Honestly, I think it's to realize that things can and will change, and oftentimes things can and will change drastically. And I'm not just talking about because a team signs a player. Like if Carolina signs CJ Anderson, of course Christian McCaffrey's projection is going to change. I'm just talking about learning new information and analyzing things yourself to realize that you may have been wrong from the start. That could be at the team level, which will then change everything within that team, or just an individual player level. So the lesson is, don't be afraid to be wrong at the start. And don't be afraid to be wrong, period. This is a game of probability. There is variance. You're going to be wrong. It's going to happen. That's it for today's mailbag show, though, everyone. Thanks again for listening. If you've yet to subscribe to the Late Round Podcast, make sure that you are by searching for it on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, SoundCloud, and TuneIn. And guys, when you're on iTunes, if you could leave me a rating and review, that would be greatly, greatly appreciated. And if you're not following me on Twitter, I'm on there, @LateRoundQB. Thanks, everyone. Enjoy your weekend, and I'll talk to you next week.